It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The National Journal calls him the Democratic Senate candidate who drives Democrats crazy. He's former Pennsylvania congressman and U.S. Navy three-star Admiral Joe Sestak. In 2010, he defeated 30-year incumbent Arlen Specter in the Democratic primary and came within 2 percentage points of beating Republican Pat Toomey. But close is not good enough for some Democrats who would rather see another candidate take on Toomey. But Joe Sestak doesn't appear anywhere near ready to leave the race. He joins us now in Studio A. Admiral Sestak, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Good to be with you, Paul. Great to be in the city.
Now, you don't mind me greeting you that way. Some others, however, might. There's a story in today's Pittsburgh Tribune Review that says your use of the title Admiral in campaign literature appears to violate Pentagon rules. And I'll point out that you served in the Navy for 31 years and rose to the rank of Admiral. According to this story, Department of Defense ethics guidelines say retirees not on active duty can mention their military rank or service affiliation when campaigning for federal office, but must clearly indicate their retired or reserve status. And the rules were apparently designed to prevent any implication of official endorsement or approval of military members' participation in political activity. So the issue for some is that there is no clear indication in the literature that you have retired. So what about all this?
No, actually, I say former admiral and congressman to make sure everyone knows that I'm not an active service member nor an active congressman.
So you feel that you have done your due diligence to make this clarification.
Well, I'm not aware of this particular memo, but what you said, first time I've heard of it. But I felt I want to make sure everybody, like on our website, every press release that goes out, I just want people to know I'm still not active, because I just want to know as a former both congressman and admiral.
Retired Army General Tony Kukulo, he was quoted as saying that you cannot run using your military title and a true professional soldier would not do that.
Did he say that whole quote?
That is a quote.
Yeah.
That is an exact quote that appears in today's Pittsburgh Tribune Review.
I don't know Tony at all.
Enough said?
Yes. I mean, we've always said former admiral and congressman.
What would you say are the advantages of having a military background like yours and how it would help you if you get to the Senate?
You know, I walking across the state of Pennsylvania, the first day there when I announced my candidacy, I stood in front of Independence Hall. I held up the combat boots that I'd worn on the ground in Afghanistan. And I said, I'm going to walk in the shoes of Pennsylvanians, a different group every day. But that first day, I'm going to walk in the shoes of my fellow veterans. We served our country. Whether you're a sergeant, whether you're called sergeant today, corporal, private, or whether you're called admiral, we're all common brethren. The next day, I was in another pair of shoes, those of the poor, the underserved. The next day, those who had domestic abuse have suffered. And then small businesses. Today, I just did foreign policy. And to your specific question, I think what it brings as I walk across the state, that someone who has served in the military understands accountability, answering for oneself, for one's deeds, not just what one says. There's too many of our politicians, like Senator Toomey, who has said, I care about my veterans. Their suicide rate is too high, but for whatever reason, he's voted against 10 straight veterans appropriations bill since he voted to send us to war. I was commanding an aircraft carrier. When he actually visited our carrier and he came back and he said the suicide rate of our veterans is too high, but then he voted against the bipartisan health benefits bill, which was to increase the care for PTSD of veterans. So I think my sense of that I was in the military gives people a knowledge that you can trust me for what I will say I will do. And so we honor one another as veterans for having served together, whether you call me admiral or Joe. But amongst ourselves, it's often like I was talking to Chief Petty Officer the other day. I said, Chief, how are you in your county? He says, I'm a Republican, but I want to support you. I think there's that understanding that you can trust somebody. That's what we got out of the military.
So you're walking in across the state and in these military boots symbolizes your what you want people to know about your ability to identify with soldiers.
Correct. No. Identify with them. See, the first day was Voots with my veterans, but then each day
with
Pennsylvanians. See, I just did an event for small business owners because, unfortunately, they don't get access to capital to be all they can be, and regulations are too harsh on them. Then I did one for women's, in a sense, walking in their shoes, because a woman today, take the Paycheck Fairness Act, makes 77 cents to 92 cents on the dollar as a guy. Now, Senator Toomey has filibustered three times the Paycheck Fairness Act, saying it's an undue burden. We shouldn't make it equal. But I wanted women to understand that I will walk in their shoes. I have six sisters, so it's relatively easy, but to understand the challenge they go through. So the walk that I'm doing, 422 miles, that I'll end on Saturday across Pennsylvania, walking literally every foot of the way, but figuratively in the boots, the shoes of somebody, different group of people of day, is to say, I'd like to begin to earn your trust. I'd like to be able that you would say that whatever I say here in Pennsylvania, I will do down there. And we veterans, whether you call me Admiral or Joe, or whether, you know, I call a fellow veteran Chief or Jim, we understand that. And I think that's what we bring for the military when we go into public service.
And you are you have not completed this 422-mile walk. You are still in the middle of it. There are people who have raised some doubt about whether you are walking all of these miles. So I'll just ask you, are you walking all of these miles?
Well, ask Colby, who's here.
Colby, well,
Washington Post, who has gone with me today, went back to where I began. Yes,
I wasn't going to. I wasn't going to bring Colby into this, but
well, she, I have a witness.
She's documenting this trek for the Washington Post. So you can just say yes or no. Or you can just nod your head. Colby has, in fact, Congressman Sestak walked all of these miles.
From what I've seen today, we walked 8 miles this morning.
Let's get you on mic. There you go.
I walked 8 miles with him this morning, and he picked up where he left off last night.
Right back to where we left off. We got 2 or 3 more interviews to do after you, Paul. We go back. You know, I told Colby, I showed her the tracker, who actually, if you remember, Colby, I said, you know, Senator Toomey has a video guy following me. And whenever I get in a car, I stop, and then I have to go to, like, someone's house to sleep, or I had to go to an event, or I came to this radio show. Instead of walking another 10 miles to this radio show, we drive over, and that will go right back to where we left off. But look, it's politics for him to take a picture and put it out there, but that's something you don't mess around with that in the military. And I think that's why I want to serve. I don't like these games that people play. I think when people are hurting and the medium level of income of Pennsylvanians is less today than it was 20 years ago, and half means half of people in Pennsylvania's working families earning less, that's the issue that Senator Toomey should be addressing, not these kind of games.
Well, let's talk about economics. What are the main social and economic issues you intend to highlight in this campaign? Just listening to you now, you have brought up what others have, and that is the concern that in America there's a lot of income disparity. We see it here in Pennsylvania. We see it around the country. People are aware of the problem, but we haven't heard a whole lot of in the way of solutions to it. What would be your way of helping the middle class?
Yes. I think income inequality proscribes a lot of other options. There is income inequality. But if you just look at it that way, then you primarily can either have a more progressive tax system or you can have more distributions, so to speak, from government. But I think it's more than that. I call it economic mobility. I actually taught the course at Carnegie Mellon University the last couple of years right here in Pittsburgh because I love this city. And what it involves is like small businesses. They create 70% of all jobs, just like they did in 1975. But back then, 36 new small businesses sprung up for every 10,000 citizens. Paul, you know what it is today? Only 18 small businesses, not 36, spring up for every 10,000 jobs. So we researched it and found out, boy, if we could get back to 36, we'd really have our economy going because they're already creating 70% of all jobs. Two things. They need access to what is often called the mother's milk of a new small business, capital. When this small little affiliate started, they needed someone to invest in it. So my proposal is to do what Wisconsin has done. They cut, if someone invests in a new startup, that investor gets 50% tax credit right off. They've quadrupled the investors into small business. The second is regulatory burden on small businesses. It costs 40% more for a small business to handle the harsh regulations upon it than it does for a hard regulation than it does for a large corporation. So if you can get lift the regulatory burden off of small businesses, the benefit is better than that regulation on it being overly more stringent than it needs to be, and give them access. So those are the kind of things. The second one, of course, is human capital. It's why I was teaching. Our youth is our national treasure. And to have the proper investment, take community colleges. Only about 6 or 7% of our colleges in Pennsylvania are community colleges. But, Paul, did you know nationwide it's actually about 30%, 28% are community colleges. So if we could get our community colleges up to a larger number, those youth that want to go and learn MIG or TIG weld and become the artisans will have better access to it. So those are the kinds of issues that I believe that Pennsylvanians, and I've actually heard from them, want access to quality education. And number two, let's get our small business going where the near majority of Pennsylvanians work.
It's the Central Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we are talking with former Pennsylvania Congressman and former U.S. Navy three-star General Joe Sestak, who is running for U.S. Senate. He is going to take on the incumbent Republican Senator Pat Toomey once again, and he is in the process of kicking off his campaign almost to the finish line of his 422-mile walk.
3 days to go.
Across the state of Pennsylvania, three more days to go. If you'd like to join the conversation, if you have a comment or question for Joe Sestak, our number is 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email address esspgh@wesa.fm. On Twitter at esspgh. I wanted to bring up something that you have weighed in on, and I should point out that you served as President Clinton's director for defense policy at the National Security Council in the White House, and you have been critical of the man that you're opposing in the U.S. Senate race, Pat Toomey, taking issue with his being one of those who signed a letter disavowing President Obama's efforts to negotiate with Iran on the nuclear weapons issue. Why?
Well, I've been to about 80 countries in the world during my naval service. I served, as you said, in the White House, and I served for General Powell and Admiral Bill Crowe as political military analyst in Joint Chiefs and in Congress. But what I saw is the unrivaled respect that the presidency of the United States has as it goes as the foremost instrument to secure our freedoms and our security overseas. To actually have had Senator Toomey sign a letter to the Ayatollah, the supreme leader of Iran, an adversarial nation, an Ayatollah who has said death to America, for Senator Toomey to sign a letter that says disregard our presidency shows a reckless abandon of the responsibilities of a senator. It shows truly no experience in world affairs, and it also shows a disregard for the security of America, placing politics above security. It used to be in the days, even before this letter was signed, that partisanship stopped at the shoreline. Look, if you want the president to bring the agreement or the treaty or whatever into the Senate, you should disagree with that here in America. But don't divide our nation by saying our president doesn't matter by signing that letter overseas. I guess you could see there are senators like John McCain who said, whoa, sorry, this is kind of was rushed through and we didn't look at it. But a senator like Senator Toomey, who voted for that tragic misadventure in Iraq, then he came home and voted against 10 straight veterans appropriations bills. He doesn't have skin in the game, and he left no other option if his letter derailed the negotiations than war to stop their nuclear program. That's the shame of it.
Yesterday, Army Sergeant Bo Bergdahl, who abandoned his post in Afghanistan and was held captive for 5 years by the Taliban, was charged with desertion. What do you feel should happen to Sergeant Bergdahl?
I don't know what exactly should happen as far as the appropriate punishment or not. But I do know this, that accountability matters in the United States military. And as I said to you a little earlier, Paul, accountability matters most more than anything else in our nation today because of the lack in our leaders of both parties of it. I mean, who's ever been held accountable for not finding the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? That Senator Toomey voted and said, let's go and get them. Who's ever been accountable for Wall Street
And let's clarify that. You're saying that when he was a congressman,
he voted for the war in Iraq. And how about Wall Street, where he voted to remove that law that let commercial banks begin to gamble with our money through derivatives where before they were precluded? And so whose response held accountable for Katrina? And you begin to say, you know, Paul, this isn't right that we don't have accountability any longer in our political leaders. In the military, under a thorough review, they found that this soldier had abandoned his post and was charged with a desertion. Now they need to go through and hold him accountable with the appropriate with the POVI system will determine what that is. But accountability is very important because, as a Wall Street editorial said in 1952, after Captain was going to be held accountable for his ship running into an aircraft carrier, said nowhere else, it seems, but on the seas is there true accountability anymore. And you must have it. And Wyatt would like to be part of the team that helps to bring that back in the United States Senate.
412-246-2002 to join the conversation with former Congressman and former U.S. Navy Admiral Joe Sestak, who is running for Senate, running again in 2016 against the incumbent Republican Senator Pat Toomey. Let's go to the phones. We have Nick in the North Hills with a question. Nick, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you. Sir, first of all, I'd like to thank you for your service.
Thank you.
Another question I have, well, I'd like to say that I'd like to keep both offices or both parties in Senate, but you're really making a lot of sense, and it really sounds good. And I was wondering if you're going to be speaking in the Pittsburgh area where we can actually come and speak with you and meet with you. And the other question I have is just about policy, is as far as income tax and progressive taxes, et cetera, what are your feelings on just a straight flat tax and make it equitable across the board?
Yes, two questions. Tomorrow, if you don't mind, at 10 a.m., I will be at the Regatta Bar and Grill at 777 Aiton Road, A-T-E-N Road. And we're going to have a discussion on energy and the environment. I just did one on foreign policy today, and I'm sorry that the word hadn't gotten to you. But I'd be honored if you might stop by.
What about Nick's question on the flat tax?
The flat tax, I looked at the analysis of it. It sounds tremendous. The problem is that you lose the progressive tax rate that we have because the tax, for example, on someone who makes $20,000 will be the same as the tax on someone who makes $1 million. And so you lose the progressiveness of it. Look, we used to have a high tax rate under President Eisenhower of 90% for the top tax bracket. Under Kennedy, it went to 70. Now it's about 33-35%. And so I think that if you just have this flat tax on income, you don't capture, like, unless you include in it the income of the capital gains taxes of the rich and the more fortunate. So it's a good, simple idea, but when you look at it underneath, you find that, well, maybe if the more well-to-do are able to use the roads for their businesses to make goods, well, maybe the more progressive tax system we have now, particularly since we took the top tax rate from 90% since 1958 down to 33-35%, is probably fairer.
Let's go to Jacob in Pittsburgh. Jacob, you're on with Joe Sestak.
I just have to tell you, I love you, Mr. Sestak. I think you're fantastic. But I had a question about student loan debt and how would you handle something like that? It's something that holds so many of us back, or even getting funding to go to school. There's so many jobs that are available out there, but people can't get them because they're not qualified and don't have the opportunity to get back to school.
There's two approaches I would like to see to address both the supply side and the demand side. Let's take the supply side. I mean, right now, we don't even know by law or regulation what the public university Penn State's salaries are. They pay their president and other people. I believe that we should do what we did for women in public schools, that back when we used to say, hey, you know, you got two sports for women, five sports for guys, that's not right. We're giving you public money. It should be equal number of sports. And because we did that, you had the Atlantic Olympics occur And boom, those women won everything because they had equality of opportunity. I think that since Pell Grants and Stafford Loans are given to our public universities and private, that they then have to sign some sunshine on their books. Where's the money going? What's the graduation rate? And I think that sunshine, as the Quakers say, let the light shine upon you, can only help. And I voted for that when I was in Congress. It didn't get through with the Senate. Number two is the demand side. Look, I think a proposal like Elizabeth Warren has is, I have to tell you, is I don't agree with, where she wants the Federal Reserve to say, we give for almost no interest rate monies to banks, but they have collateral, to companies. But students don't have collateral. What's better is this. We can lower the rate than what it is now for student loans by saying, you know, about most of the 3/4 or so of student loans are paid off by the 23rd year. The next big hawk is about 28 years. So what we want to do is base it on a bond where 75% of the rate is figured by a 20-year bond, and the other fourth of it is rated by a 30-year bond. When you figure that interest rate out, it's a fair return for the government because right now it's making money because the rate's too high. And with lowering it, they get a fair return on their investment, which is near zero. And so I think there's a better way if you look at the facts, approach it in an accountable way. Now, that doesn't solve the problem immediately, those with all this debt, but it begins to fix the problem, particularly shining sunshine on where our money is being spent as taxpayers.
Let's go to Rose in Pittsburgh, who is referring to an issue you talked about earlier. Go ahead, Rose.
You make a lot of sense, most of your points. I just wanted to ask, I do agree with you, accountability, but I have two questions. Who was accountable for the mess in Benghazi? I have never seen anybody brought to task for that our embassy chief was raped in the streets. And number two, who is accountable? I understand the income disparity, but that's a personal choice if I want to start having children when I'm 14. Or 15 and have 6 or 8. I think single parenthood causes a lot of inequality and social status and such other items.
On the first one, look, I have to agree. I would support as many investigations as it takes, and it should have taken a nonpartisan one to find out what truly went down in Benghazi. Look, I know that the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mullen, conducted one, and seemed as though there was others that found a little bit more. So I don't quite know what the final answer is. I think we know it pretty well, but I would support any type of investigation done in a non-witch hunt way by both parties into anything that happens like Benghazi or anything else. Number two, I hope I heard the question correctly on single babies. On it. You know, China has a single baby policy, and it's funny. She's in a race for time. She only has about 30 years because her single baby policy has really harmed it. In a sense, they're going to have more seniors that there won't have enough youth and middle age people to actually be productive. That's why they are establishing fishing rights in the South China Sea and saying we're the only ones who can fish here. That's why they're establishing ownership of the South China Sea to get the minerals underneath because they're trying to get an Aussie and Harriet home for everyone before they're too gentrified in order to do it. So I hope I interpreted that last question right.
Yeah,
I
just she was think talking about single parenting and wage equality for women who choose single parenthood.
Oh, to me, if that's what a person chooses, why not? Did I hear the question right? Was she complaining about it? I apologize.
It might have been hard to follow her exact train of thought.
I owe her a good answer, though. What was the question?
But she was talking about single parenting and wage equality for women who choose single parenthood.
Here's what I do. Two-thirds of all women, two-thirds of everyone on a minimum wage, for example, are women. Two-thirds of them are working women with a child, and so many are single moms. That's why I'm for increasing the minimum wage up until $10.12, because if you don't rise it above 50% of the average hourly wage, studies and actual case studies of New Jersey raising the wage to that amount and Pennsylvania not shows no jobs are lost. Second, I'm for the Paycheck Fairness Act, where women earn 77 cents to 92 cents on the dollar of this guy. Now, Senator Toomey has filibustered that three times, saying, you know, it's a burden for us to make it fair for women to get the same pay as a man. Like my wife did not get the same amount of pay that a guy hired 5 years after her for an equivalent job, got a lot more. And so I'm for the Paycheck Fairness Act and raising the minimum wage $10.12 because so many women who are working, single moms, are on it.
Let's take one last call from Ann in Friendship.
Please accept my misunderstanding of your question at first.
I would hope Rose understands. Thank you, Rose from Pittsburgh. Let's go to Ann in Friendship. Ann, welcome. You're on with Joe Sestak. Is that Ann? I guess we lost Ann. I have some points I wanted to get to before we wrap this up. And one of the things that I think is important to mention is with so many this influx of veterans who are coming home from Afghanistan. We've had a lot who have returned in recent years from Iraq. We've got plenty of Korean and, of course, Vietnam War veterans and a lot of problems. Is the system overloaded? Yeah. Why are we seeing homeless veterans? Why are we seeing mental issues that aren't mental health yeah. issues that aren't being addressed? Job training just help that veterans need who so often has been documented in recent years have fallen through the cracks.
When I went to Congress, we increased the funding for our veterans coming home, 33% of which have a mental challenge, including PTSD, by $10 billion, the largest increase ever in VA appropriated funding. But I go to a prison every year, Paul, when I was a congressman, and even now when I'm not one, because I didn't want to think I forgot them to think I forgot them, because we vets truly are our brethren. And so many are there, 47% for drug or alcohol-related crime because they had a mental challenge. We didn't take care of them, and they got into drugs, and all of a sudden there's a crime to get the money for it. So that's why, Paul, I really do want to go to the Senate. Look, again, I'll come back. Homelessness. We have one out of every five individuals who are homeless is a veteran. And yet Senator Toomey voted against the HUD bill that actually has home vouchers for homeless veterans as well as the VA bill. You're right. Benefits are delayed up to a year. And he has said here in Pennsylvania, my gosh, there's too much of a benefit backlog. But he voted against 10 veterans appropriations bill where we had additional caseworkers in there. So in short, we do need to get people down there that understand we owe those who are double the citizen, a veteran, as well as when they come home, they're a normal citizen, our support, because they are part of the war cost.
We have an email from, I can't tell if it's Gene or Jenner. At any rate, this person says, any comments on huge tax cuts for large profitable oil companies? Senator Toomey has voted against removing tax subsidies.
Yes, Senator Toomey, she's right, has voted to support $70 to $80 billion every year for gas and oil companies, as well as voting for to drill in Lake Erie. However, I do support, and I don't agree with that. They've made it. We gave our natural gas right here in Pennsylvania, those that drill here, $10 billion in tax credit. They've made it. But the key is renewables. We are on the cusp of having the renewables be the same price as natural gas. We'll be there in a couple of years without subsidies. But right now, to give them subsidies to help develop, like we did the Navy developing the sonar for frackers, we can do that to where we want them to be rugged individuals, these companies, and make it. But if with a little bit of investment, we're all going to in the Commonwealth benefit. So that's where I would put the effort. And you know what? A wind turbine is 400 tons of steel. Imagine the manufacturing you could do here in Pittsburgh if we, not China, are the manufacturers of the renewable wind turbines that populate Franklin County and other places, and we get more and more.
That was a question from Gene, as it turns out. So thanks to that gentleman. Very quickly, what about Obamacare?
I'm sitting in Westmoreland County with you today, which has the second lowest premiums on the individualized exchange. In fact, all across Pennsylvania, the individualized exchange premiums, whether it's the gold or the silver, whichever plan, are less today than employer-based premiums, which have gone up 150%. In fact, the health care cost over the last 4 years has gone from 6% the decade before each year to 3%. In fact, CBO, Congressional Budget Office, said last month, the Affordable Care Act is costing $100 billion less. Why? Because 25% more insurance companies entered the market this year. All we did is set up an eBay, pick your plan, and now a woman doesn't pay twice as much as a man. No, it is a success. Shameful transition because people weren't accountable for rolling out a good website, But it's working, and it makes us a more productive nation.
And I think people would forgive you this because you've been moving through Pennsylvania and going through a lot of counties, but we're actually in Allegheny County, close to
did
Westmoreland.
I say Allegheny? I thought I did.
You said Westmoreland.
Just walked out of Westmoreland last night.
We're in Allegheny now.
And Allegheny also is tied. All Western Pennsylvania actually has the second lowest premiums on the individualized exchange.
So are you this loose cannon, you know, going back to how I introduced this whole thing and set it up, that, you know, why are Democrats worried about you? Why?
Well,
some
as
of
you
them
know,
that-
a couple of those that you read were from a Republican person who, you know, set those. But all that said, the Democrats are absolutely right. No, I am an independent who for 31 years in the
an
Navy.
An independent Democrat?
I was an independent for 31 years in the Navy, but I am independent who happens to be a Democrat. My district was Republican, 55, 56% Republican, 33, 30% Democrat. My first race cost $3.5 million. Paul, you know what my second race cost?
What?
$28,000. They just put out yard signs. Why? Because they learned to trust me. Republicans didn't always agree with me. So, no, I understand that the establishment sometimes feels that my independence is something that is important to me but maybe not to them. You see, I don't believe in party. I don't believe in type. I believe in people. We the people. I believe that no one should be above accountability, answering for oneself, not for just what one says, but for what one does. And that's how I want to be, regardless of party.
I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. We have been talking with former Pennsylvania Congressman and U.S. Navy three-star Admiral Joe Sestak, candidate for the U.S. Senate in 2016, running against the Republican Pat Toomey. Joe Sestak, thank you for being with us on Essential Pittsburgh.
It's always a pleasure.
Likewise. Coming up, we'll preview a documentary about the search for the families of soldiers sketched during World War II. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Tonight, WQED debuts a new documentary called Finding Elizabeth Soldiers. Here's a preview.
We first told her story in Portraits for the Homefront.
So there she was with an easel and sketch pad.
Sketching hundreds of soldiers during World War II. Now, the legacy of Elizabeth Black continues in a new documentary.
It was a huge undertaking.
100 sketches drawn in Europe decades ago found among Elizabeth's keepsakes.
Our goal was to find a home for them.
But how and where? We hit the road to find the families.
I just cried my eyes out.
That's my dad.
This is my father.
I just thought it was beautiful.
And better yet, we'd find some of the actual people who were sketched.
Yes, I'm very much alive. I'm 95.
The portraits were sent home to the soldiers' families. After her death, Elizabeth Black's family discovered copies of about 100 portraits in her collection. Joining us in Studio A is WQED producer David Solomon, producer of the new documentary Finding Elizabeth Soldiers. It debuts tonight at 8 on WQED-TV. David Solomon, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
What led you to decide to find the soldiers of their families and deliver the sketches to them? This is not only documenting something, but getting involved.
Right. This is turned into a great community outreach project with an awful lot of goodwill surrounding it. We obviously, as you just heard in the clip, we told her story first in the documentary back in 2013, Portraits for the Homefront. And that was essentially telling her story, that she was this wonderful Pittsburgh artist who really went unrecognized for what she did. After the documentary premiered, we still had 90-some portraits that needed a home. And we said, let's see how easy it is to find these. And it went from there.
And how have you gone about finding these people?
Well, at first we were trying to do it on our own. We had, essentially it was me and whatever group of college interns I had working with me at the time. We would do our own internet searches, but obviously, that wasn't our full-time gig, and we had other work to do, and we did what we could with our limited resources and knowledge about how to find people on the internet. And once the original documentary aired and we started getting a lot of media coverage, then volunteer researchers started reaching out saying, hey, I live in Hawaii and I know my way around the internet and I'm an amateur genealogist. I'd like to help. Michigan, Virginia, California. We started hearing from researchers in several states.
And who have you found?
We have found, I would say, more than 50% of them so far. We have found in the documentary, for example, our first challenge was to find the only woman who was sketched by Elizabeth Black. And the only thing that we had to go on was that her nickname, and you could see it on her lapel, was Lulu. And
who turns out to be?
Mary Lou Chapman, living in Berkeley, California, age 95, alive and well.
And we heard her voice there.
You heard her voice. And when we set up the appointment to do the interview, she said, well, just to warn you, I play golf on Tuesdays and I play tennis on Wednesdays. Who would have thought that?
That's what we were hearing in the background.
Right. Who would have thought we would have, A, found her alive and well, and that she would be in such great shape. And
there was a picture of going around of her, and it's been published in at least one of the newspapers here. She looks great.
She does, and she's just as smart and feisty as you can imagine. And I think that the primo thing on all of it was that she actually knew Elizabeth Black. She worked with her as a Club Mobile woman, and that's how her portrait came to be sketched. They were in England, and she said maybe the bus broke down, and Elizabeth said, here, I'll sketch you, and that's how her sketch came to be.
What have been some of the other reactions and some of the more meaningful reunions?
We had a family in Akron, Ohio, also featured in the documentary. A reporter from the Akron Beacon Journal reached out to us and said, hey, I stumbled upon your website, and there's a guy from Akron on there. Have you been able to find his family yet? And actually, I did look in my records of what the researchers had fed me, and I did find that some contact information was there. We had not reached out to the family contacts yet. And I said, well, yeah, I do actually have something on what we think are one of his daughters. I'll call her up and see if I've got the right person. I called her up. She answered the phone, which is, yeah, usually that's the first strike. Mm-hmm. But she answered the phone, and she didn't hang up on me. And we talked, and sure enough, we had the right family. It was her father's portrait that we had. She had no idea that it existed. And, of course, she was knocked off her chair.
How many more people are there to find, and how long will you keep trying to find them?
Well, we will continue on. As long as it takes. We won't necessarily be going full throttle. We'll depend on the kindness of volunteer researchers to help us, but we'll keep on going until we hit all the dead ends.
David Solomon is producer of the new documentary, Finding Elizabeth Soldiers. It debuts tonight at 8 on WQED-TV, and I'm sure it's going to pull at a lot of people's heartstrings. David Solomon, congratulations on your work, and thank you for taking the time to join us here on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, we'll meet Bronx Obama. He's not the president, but he's close, when Essential Pittsburgh continues on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. When Louis Ortiz shaved off his goatee one day in 2008, his life changed forever. He looked in the mirror and he did not see himself, a middle-aged, unemployed Puerto Rican father from the Bronx. He saw the face of change, of hope, of money. His uncanny resemblance to the new Democratic Party candidate, soon to be president, Barack Obama, opened a totally unexpected new career for Mr. Ortiz, whose fortunes changed overnight. He won a shadow fame and, if not a fortune, at least a gig as an Obama impersonator. But Mr. Ortiz discovers the pitfalls and uncertainties of a showbiz career and struggles with both the consequences in his private life. In the documentary directed by Ryan Murdoch, which captures these unexpectedly hilarious moments in the film Bronx Obama, which screens tonight at 7 at McConomy Hall on the campus of Carnegie Mellon University. It's part of the Carnegie Mellon International Film Festival. Let's begin by listening to a clip from the early part of the film.
Thank you, everybody. Have a seat, everybody. I know, I can't believe it's me either. America, let us not be distracted by this warped view of reality. I mean, we're making real and lasting change. Presidents are now available in black. That's right.
Joining us now in Studio A is Luis Ortiz, a.k.a. Bronx Obama. Mr. Ortiz slash Mr. President, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. And how you doing, Pittsburgh?
Pittsburgh is happy to have you, and I'm guessing curious about seeing this film. Also with us is the director, Ryan Murdoch. Ryan, thank you for being here. Very interesting piece, 91 minutes or so of documentary that you put together on this man's adventurous ordeal.
Thanks for having me. You know, Lewis has this sort of Twilight Zone kind of life. It was actually the first thing he said to me when I talked to him on the phone and proposed following him around for a couple years. He said, "Oh, I'm so glad you called. I live in the Twilight Zone. My life is really weird." And that kind of hooked me immediately. I said, this guy has this interesting visual kind of weird thing happen. He's an interesting person on his own. And here's a way to look at the Obama years through the eyes of just kind of a regular person who also connects with people in this really powerful way.
Mr. Ortiz is sitting right in front of me, and we'll have pictures on our website at WESA.FM, and certainly you can go online and find any number of images. But, man, it's amazing. And I have been fortunate enough to have met the president before he became president. You use a little makeup, but, man, you are almost identical. You could be his identical twin. When was it that it struck you that – I look just like the president, or maybe even was before he became president. I look like Senator Obama.
Yeah, it's when he was a senator running against Hillary in the primaries, I discovered the look, and I could not believe what I saw in the mirror.
You were shaving.
I was shaving, and well, I don't want to give too much of the film away. That's
okay.
The beginning of the film.
Sure, sure. But all right, so then that's how you come to realize that you resemble him. So how do you end up becoming – how do you end up deciding, okay, I can make a living doing this? What convinces you that it's time to take this show on the road, as it were?
Plain and simply, I'm an American. This is the last capitalist nation in the world. If, you know, if you discovered that you look like – you know, the possible first African-American president, wouldn't you capitalize on it somehow?
I don't know. I mean, I put it this way. After seeing the film, you have gone through a lot. This is not an easy thing. You have learned to master the president's cadence and his voice quality, we'll get into some of that. We heard a little bit of it in the clip, and we'll get into more of it. But you've had a coach work with you, a man who, as we see in Ryan's film, is a good coach, but he's a very difficult individual to deal with, and as we come to find out, a felon to boot.
Well, you know, I cannot take anything away from what you just said. He was a great coach, but there's a thing called positive reinforcement and negative reinforcement. And I was definitely negatively reinforced, and it was a six-month ordeal working with him. And I sucked all the information I needed out of him, and I was gone.
He whipped you into shape in terms of your ability to imitate, not because the resemblance is uncanny, but then you've got to get – you have a thick Bronx accent in your regular life, and you had
yes.
to kind of iron that out. And so I will ask you so now I'm going to let you get into your President Obama persona, and I will ask you, you know, a lot of Americans, Mr. President, are concerned about our private lives being compromised by phone records being accessed by government agencies. You know, what is your response to that?
Well, you see, here's the thing. I know you guys are upset about the NSA spying on Americans, but let me be perfectly clear. I know exactly who you are, and if you have any specific complaints, no need to contact me directly. Just send an email, make a phone call, send a text to anyone, anywhere, and we'll look right into it.
President Obama, and that's Bronx Obama, portrayed by Luis Ortiz, who is our guest today, and the subject of the film, Bronx Obama. you know, with all the bipartisanship, there is some bipartisanship, but there's also a partisan divide in America. So describe the gamut of reactions that you get as you go out in public. You know, how are people dealing with you?
Well,
how are you dealing with them?
Let me just start by saying it is not all fun and games looking like them. It's not easy looking like Obese. But I'm from the Bronx. You know, I got some thick skin and very street smart. And I incorporate all that into my daily Obama, you know, mannerisms and just trying to deal with people. I'm a pretty sociable guy, so something negative comes my way, I'll turn it into some positive stuff without too much altercation.
When you came into our lobby today here on the south side of where we're located, you know, so there were some people doing double takes. Are there people that think they're talking to the president when they're talking to you?
Ryan, take this one, please.
Well, you know, and part of the reason why I was interested in following Lewis is everywhere he goes, you have this moment where people, you just kind of watch their brain sort of short circuit, and they think it's the president. Then they convince themselves, no, it's not. But like, wow, he really looks like, and in some ways, it's an emotional reaction, and sort of the logical part of their brain just sort of shuts off. And Obama's image is so powerful that people have these emotional feelings about him that are very strong in both directions. And that really fascinated me. Here's this moment where people just sort of let down the guard and let out exactly what they feel about Obama. They know it's not him, but they want to indulge the fantasy because they have these emotions inside them that they don't know what to do with. And Lewis is really good at parsing that. He'll take people who, you know, women want to give him kisses on the cheek. He's posed for literally hundreds of thousands of selfies. And then he's also gets people who want to, you know, debate the finer points of Obamacare with him.
What about people who say, I would have to think that at some point you've been on the receiving end of some insults and probably some racist insults?
Yes, that comes on the regular, but,
like what, how, what is being said to you?
Oh, can I say that on air?
I would probably avoid it.
They're
the N-word, is that what we're
yeah,
saying?
Yeah, I mean, I get the N-word. I get, you look like, you know, that N-word. And I'm like, really?
are you dealing with the average American, perhaps more? Have you thought about this, that you're bumping up against average citizens more than the president, who is actually, you know, he is by design holding people at arm's length. There's security, he's brushing by people. Nobody really gets to interact with them. They're probably interacting more with you.
Yes, they are. I am the official lightning rod for Barack Obama.
Now, there's a clip in the movie, and we're running out of time, so we're not going to play it. I'm going to have you just this particular topic here, where they're talking about what happens if you lose the election when you were going around during the 2012 campaign. How did you respond to that question? And if you can do so as the president,
you mean
that right there? Yeah.
Okay. That was a scripted, you know,
right.
A scripted line. And
the line is?
The line is, Mr. President, what was that line again?
Mr. President, what will happen if you lose the election? You know, have you considered the idea of having to vacate the White House?
Well, I don't know if you guys got the memo, but it's extremely difficult to kick a black family out of public housing. Now, a lot of oohs and ahs out there right now, but that was what I was dealing with under that management. And
right,
that
and there's – it's race – it's – I mean –
Yeah, it's race-driven.
Race-driven material. I mean, is that – you know, was that offensive to you?
It was offensive to me, and it still is, but it was my road to becoming an entertainer, and it was unfortunate that I had to run into that type of management at first.
We are just about out of time, so very quickly, you got into this to make a fortune. Have you? Are you?
That's a matter of national security.
Okay. The film is Bronx Obama. It screens tonight at 7 at McConomy Hall on the campus of Carnegie Mellon University. Our guests have been Luis Ortiz, who is a dead ringer for President Obama and has been impersonating him for years, and director Ryan Murdoch, who captures his story in the film Bronx Obama. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us today on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you very
much. Thanks for having us.
I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.